This is the Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Jason Brown, in for Rachel McDonald. Thanks for tuning in. We're once again joined by Dr. Patrick Ludke, Senior Public Health Officer for Lane County. Dr. Ludke, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Jason, and happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday, Dr. Ludke. So today, Governor Brown spoke, and she had a rather cautious message for Oregonians, stating that we're now in the fourth surge of the coronavirus pandemic, noting that today's cases exceed 1,000 and that hospitals are now on track to surpass 300 patients with COVID-19. So to start things off, Dr. Ludke, can you talk a bit about that? And maybe as a way to introduce this topic, how do you think we got here?
That's a really good question. I think we got here several ways. The first is some people have let their guard down, which is unfortunate. We know the virus has not gone away. It's been out there. The numbers decreased in March. People probably got comfortable with that. And then we had several weeks of bright, sunny weather, which is kind of unusual in April, and people let their guard down a bit more. So that's number one. Number two, we are suffering a little bit from the return of spring break. This virus has an incubation period out to 14 days. And typically after spring break, or any time when a large number of people go somewhere and perhaps get exposed elsewhere and bring things back here, you have to go through one or two incubation periods before you start to see an impact. We're seeing some of that. And then finally, K through 12 schools have returned, and we're not the only county that has seen a significant increase in K through 12 cases as part of return to school. So yes, those are probably the big three reasons, and we have too many cases in this county at the present time, and we're cautiously looking at the horizon and a little bit nervous at the moment.
Now, you mentioned school-age children. Are there any other particular populations that we're seeing this increase in cases in here in Lane County?
Well, young adults are back in the mix, too. So if you remember, perhaps some of the listeners will, through the summer of last year, we didn't have a lot of young adults with cases. And then the fall came, and we started to see large increases in adolescents, young adults up to age 30 or so. And over the course of about a month, maybe 6 weeks, we work with the university, other colleges, with some entities that have a fair number of people who are young adult age, and we got that under reasonable control. Well, now it's back again. A lot of people in the college setting, young adult setting, probably letting their guard down. They're not yet vaccinated. We hope they get vaccinated soon, but that's another group.
I think some people are curious to wonder when new cases are diagnosed now that it's after the point that some people are getting the vaccine. Is that something they're checking on positive cases? Are they checking if they've been vaccinated or not? And are there any significant data, you know, associated with that sort of tracking?
We do ask about vaccine status, and that is all part of our contact tracing case investigation work. And those persons who have a so-called breakthrough infection, meaning that they were fully vaccinated with one of the COVID vaccines that's on the market, and yet they still became infected, we oftentimes will test them to see if they have some crazy variant that we don't know about, and learn more about what's happening in our community. So yes, that is absolutely going on.
So as we're talking about this sort of snapshot of where we're at in terms of the virus, and we're sitting in this fourth surge, as Governor Brown has said earlier today, what can we do going forward, and how does the timeline of when vaccines might become available in increased numbers play into like, what's the timeline and what behavior should we be sticking with for this time?
Well, I think I'd make two points here. The first is, I suspect many of us remember Dr. Tony Fauci and others saying the virus is in control for many months last year. We had limited testing ability. We had no vaccine. We had no antivirals. We didn't know all of the natural history of this virus. The virus was really in control. But things are different now. If we choose to exercise control, we can, because we have control over this virus now. We are choosing, it seems, to not exercise that control. We have antivirals that work. We have vaccines that work. Neither one of those are perfect, but they sure are helpful. We have better protocols for hospitalized patients who are really ill, understanding use of some of these fancy medications and some less fancy medications, like when to use steroids and when not in really sick hospitalized patients, we have much more control. We need to exercise that control as a population. And then second, outside of fancy medications and really expensive things, the good old bread and butter everybody has been hearing for a long time is really important. And we have seen parallel decreases in many other conditions. It's a surprise to some of us in public health that we didn't have a whooping cough outbreak this year. We had one in 2018, and whooping cough occurs in cycles every 3 to 5 years. We were in the window of getting more whooping cough. Well, so many people were wearing masks, we didn't get any whooping cough. We saw almost no influenza this year because masks help stop that, just like it's helping stop the COVID virus transmission. So we have control if we choose to exercise it.
You know, that's an interesting point that you just brought up about influenza. And, you know, other people have noted how much of a reduced season we've had from that. Do you imagine people taking a lesson from that and, you know, changing our approach in how we go out in public with regards to airborne disease in general? And might people be more inclined to, say, wear a mask when they go to the grocery store just because it's flu season, you know, going forward?
You know, Jason, I think some people will. It will not be adopted wholesale, right? That's just not the way our population acts. But there, I can't imagine we will not begin seeing every fall and winter some people who are wearing masks. It has become much more socially acceptable because of this pandemic. And we saw that behavior in Southeast Asia after SARS in 2002, 2003. And ever since then, it is not uncommon to see pictures in large cities, Shanghai and Beijing and Tokyo in Southeast Asia, for the last 15, 18 years where people are wearing masks. And they didn't have a SARS outbreak there, you know, in 2012. And yet that behavior that changed after 2002, 2003 SARS continued. So I do believe that it will become the norm for some people. It will be part of the winter wear. Break out your sweaters and winter coats and also the masks.
So I think another headline from the past 24 hours that's on people's minds is the unfortunate incident of an Oregon woman who developed a serious blood clot and died within 2 weeks of receiving the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It should be noted right here that the Oregon Health Authority states that it's too early to assume a connection between those events until a full investigation is completed. And also, meanwhile, it was in the New York Times and NPR picked this up that a panel of advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention voted to recommend lifting the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and adding a label about a, quote, exceedingly uncommon but potentially dangerous blood clotting disorder, end quote. So what about that, Dr. Ludke? If the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is offered back up, should people have concerns about taking it? Does that calculation change based upon certain demographics? And are the risks associated with it still lower than the risk of getting COVID-19?
So, you know, Jason, there's no good news here. Any death is sadness for not just the family, but for the rest of us. And especially a death, we don't have all the data. And then we just kind of wonder, gosh, what really happened? That being said, there are some areas here that provide a little bit of hope. So first of all, I personally believe, and I'm not alone in this space, that we have watched science at work with regard to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I believe I've said it before on this radio show. We just don't approve medications and vaccines and medical devices and put them on the market and walk away and let companies make lots of money. We mandate what we call post-marketing surveillance. They have to do surveillance. They have to assess, they being those companies that make these products, they have to assess the long-term impact in the use of large populations, because clinical trials are much smaller populations. All of a sudden, these products are being used by millions. You might see those rare 1 in a million events. So that's how this was picked up with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We initially found 6 people with these blood clots in their brain out of about 6.8 million doses, so a little less than 1 in a million. They did that pause for a week, found a few more cases linked to it. But of note, we have cases of cerebral blood clots in your brain, long before we had COVID. It's more common in young women, especially women on other therapies like birth control pills that can also cause blood clots. So I think it's important to note that we do need more data to understand the death of the person here in Oregon. Is it clearly linked to the vaccine, or is it one of those baselines that just occurs, unfortunately? But even if it were related to the vaccine, we have many, many products where the use is the negative effects of the use are balanced with the potential negative effects of not using it. Some people choose to use birth control pills for whatever reason. We know they cause blood clots. We know they cause gallstones. We know they can cause some other problems in certain people. And yet the risk is worth the benefit to some people. There are some people who have anatomical problems, body problems. They really couldn't get pregnant. It would be unsafe to them. There are many products that way. There is no medication that's perfect. So I support what that advisory committee did, the ACIP, Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. We need to inform people that this product is not perfect. It could potentially cause blood clots in a small number of people, and have that doctor-patient relationship to decide what is the best way forward. And we do that every day in medicine, whether it's blood pressure medicine or chemotherapy or birth control pills, and we need to do the same with vaccines.
Let's turn now to some listener questions, and this one is on the topic of variants and vaccines, and it comes from Nancy in Eugene.
Hello, this is Nancy in Eugene. I have read an article that the South African virus has breached the Pfizer vaccine, and I just wondered what exactly that meant. Does that mean that the vaccine is no help with that particular variant, or does the vaccine still help somewhat but is less effective, or what exactly does that mean? Thank you. Bye.
I am happy to take that one. And you know, this is a challenging area. The reason it's challenging is because, again, this is a new virus. Even though we've now had it around for 14 months, we're still learning. And in that space of learning, there are multiple studies that come out. And some of the studies are very small, 3, 5, 10, 20 people. Others are really quite large. And we get, in this space, we get a lot of different studies. We have to interpret them. So when she says has breached the Pfizer vaccine, I believe the studies she's referring to are some small studies that have shown a significant decrease in the production of neutralizing antibody to the South Africa variant with the Pfizer vaccine. But what's really important to notice is despite a decrease in the amount of neutralizing antibodies, those antibodies that can actually kill the virus, that's still above the level that causes protection. So would we like to see even more neutralizing antibodies like we see with the Pfizer vaccine in the UK variant or the New York variant or the California variant? Yes, we would. The South Africa variant is a particularly difficult variant, but we have not yet seen any variant that has mutated away from our vaccines working. We continue to do surveillance to make sure that if one of those occurs, we're aware of it, and we try to create a vaccine for it quickly. But rest assured, right now, we have not seen any of those variants that have mutated away from effectiveness of the vaccine. A little less effectiveness for some, yes, but not no effectiveness.
You're listening to The Friday Show here on KLCC. And just a reminder that we post these programs for on-demand listening at our website, klcc.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our vaccine resource guide. It's a continually updated guide on how and where you can get scheduled for the vaccine, sorted by counties in the KLCC listening area. That's all at our website, klcc.org. Still ahead, more questions for Dr. Ludke on The Friday Show, here on KLCC. You're listening to The Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Jason Brown, in for Rachel McDonald. We're joined by Dr. Patrick Ludke, Senior Public Health Officer with Lane County Public Health. And we turn now to another listener question. This one comes from Lisa in Eugene, who is seeking guidance about singing in the choir.
Hi, my name is Lisa, and I'm from Eugene, and I'm a singer in a local community choir, and so I have questions about singing and safety. If the group is all vaccinated and inoculated, do we need to wear a mask while singing outside, and is there any safe way to sing indoors? Any guidance you could give to community choir singing would be welcomed. Thanks so much.
Oh, I like that one. I would love to hear their choir sing. So I like the fact that she said also singing outdoors. Absolutely outdoors has a markedly decreased risk of passing this virus. The big ambient air shed out there dilutes any aerosols, whether it's something coughed up or it's pollution coming out of a smokestack. So sing outdoors. If you're fully vaccinated, you can do it without a mask. Enjoy the sun. Enjoy each other's vocal harmonizations. Now, I think it's important to mention the indoor part. And if your choir, let's say there's 10 people in the choir and they're all vaccinated, fully vaccinated, they can get together, they can sing without masks, and they can do that safely. However, if the service is going on, I think she said church. I'm not sure which religion she was discussing, but I'll just go with that. You don't always know who's in the congregation. We don't know everybody's personal history. There could be somebody there who's not vaccinated. Could be somebody there who is at high risk despite being vaccinated. And it is not safe to do singing without a mask indoors in that space. We just don't know the level of risk amongst everybody in that building. So be safe in that regard. Outdoors, go ahead. Indoors, please continue to mask.
Well, speaking of summer and post-vaccine life, and I think what you might have said about activities indoors might be a clue as to how you'll answer this question. But we got an email from Aaron in Eugene who writes, I'm curious if there's any research or information about COVID-19 and swimming pools, specifically indoor pools. I would like to be able to take my kids to the pool this summer with lots of pools in the area that are indoor only. I'm curious how COVID-19 reacts with humidity with indoor pools and if being around chlorine helps to kill the virus.
So the good news here, we do have some data on chlorine. Chlorine kills the virus in the water. If it's an appropriately chlorinated pool, and if it's a commercial pool, you know, they test it all the time and they make sure it's appropriately chlorinated, the virus will not survive in there and you'll be fine. We cannot say that is true with the air outside. So even though you walk into a pool and you can smell the chlorine, I mean, we all know when you go to a hotel that the pool is down that wing, right? You can smell it. But that chlorine in the air is not at a high enough concentration to prevent transmission. So if you're outside of the pool, you still need to mask up appropriately.
What about other athletic activities? And are you anticipating that as we get later into the summer, there'll be more relaxed guidance on what activities might be considered safe?
I am anticipating that guidance. And as we continue to vaccinate more and more people, we're going to get immunity from an increased number of persons who are vaccinated. We're also going to get that natural immunity from people who are infected, and they will have immunity for some time. And then, of course, you're outdoors. The weather's warmer in the northern hemisphere where the U.S. exists, and people will not be indoors breathing all the same air and therefore spreading this virus. So we will have new guidance coming out in concert with the Oregon Health Authority around what can be done. And I think it's important to mention what can be done, can't be done now when you're fully vaccinated. If you're fully vaccinated, you can visit inside a home, a private setting without a mask, with other persons who are fully vaccinated. Please go ahead and do that. You can visit a home or another private setting without a mask in one household of unvaccinated people if they're not at risk for a severe illness. Not multiple households. Once you start getting multiple households in that situation, the risk goes up markedly higher. We do not want you to be indoors without a mask with anybody with increased risk for severe disease. These vaccines are good, but they're not perfect. 90% effective on the ground for the two messenger RNA vaccines. That's not 100%. That means 1 in 10 people are not protected.
Let's talk a little bit about juvenile cases, and we did for briefly at the top of the show, but I wanted to ask you if there's any specific data about how Lane County schools are doing now that we've had a few weeks of a partial reopening.
I don't have it all on the tip of my tongue. Clearly, we are seeing a fair number of outbreaks in K-12, and as we know from the year of data that we have, more severe infections occur as you get older. Younger kids, elementary school age, have markedly less severe cases, except for that one kind of rare illness, the multisystem inflammatory disease. We call it MISI. That is a challenge in little ones, but it's very rare, 1 in a million or so. There's only been a handful of cases in Oregon, but it's still a concern. So we have had in our area, so for example, in Douglas County, working with their health officer, I remember when many of their K-12 schools went back to school, within about 10 days, they had 19 school-related outbreaks. Now, they weren't huge outbreaks, right? It wasn't 150 people at a school, but that's still 19 outbreaks with each student having several contacts and perhaps risk to the janitors and the teachers and other staff as well, who may be at higher risk than the kids. So we need to do better in the K through 12 space. We need to help them, and families need to help their kids as well with more infection control in the school environment.
I think this would be a good time to remind listeners that this weekend there's a specific push to get Pfizer vaccines to 16 and 17-year-olds at clinics at Lane Community College and in Florence this weekend. You can schedule a vaccine by going to lanecounty.org/vax. That's V-A-X clinics. You can also get vaccine information at klcc.org. Let's turn to a voicemail from Pat and Eugene about minors and parental permission for the vaccine.
Yes, this is Pat and Eugene. I was wondering, do children from 16 to 18, do they need their parents' consent to get the vaccine? And if not, why could we not have vaccination clinics at the high schools for the kids that want to get the vaccine? Thank you very much.
Nice to hear from a fellow Pat. Thanks for the question. So she's picking my brain for an Oregon statute. I'm trying to rush through my mental Rolodex here. So there is a statute in Oregon Revised Statute 109-something. I don't know the rest of the numbers after that period, but it's ORS 109-something. And essentially, in the state of Oregon, persons 15 and above can consent without parental consent to medical and dental procedures, and that includes vaccines. For behavioral health purposes, they can consent age 14 and above, but definitely a 16-year-old, 17-year-old can go in and get the vaccine without their parental consent in Oregon. And, you know, it's nice to tell mom and dad what you're doing. I mean, when I had teenagers, I sure would want them to tell me as well, but they can consent without talking to their parents to a vaccine.
Well, Dr. Ludke, that's all the time we have for today, actually. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, and I hope we see a turnaround on this surge soon.
I'm in the same hope area that you are, Jason. Thank you much.
Dr. Patrick Ludke is a senior public health officer with Lane County Public Health, and you can send your questions for next week's Friday show to news@klcc.org as an email or voice memo, or you can leave us a voicemail at 503-877-3198. Just a reminder, if you have questions about how and where to get the COVID-19 vaccine, check out our resource guide with county-by-county details at our website, klcc.org. We had production help today from Angela Kellner and Rachel McDonald. I'm Jason Brown. Thanks so much for listening and for sharing your questions with us this week. And have a wonderful and safe weekend. This is KLCC.